Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and my guest today is a cartoonist, a historian, a biographer, a celebrated publisher, and founder of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. He has authored or co-authored a teetering stack of books, including Underground Classics, The Transformation of Comics, Al Cap, A Life to the Contrary, The Art of Harvey Kurtzman, and this one that I have in my hand, The Oddly Compelling Art of Dennis Kitchen. Dennis Kitchen, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Well, thanks, Conch. I'm happy to be here.
So your first venture into self-publishing was back at the end of the 1960s when you were fresh out of the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee, and you called your imprint Mom's Homemade Comics. How did you first get into comics? Was this a thing fresh out of diapers you were doing from the start?
Pretty much. You know, I knew from an early age, to me, comics were always fascinating, whether they were in the newspaper or comic books off the rack. I couldn't get enough of them, and I was drawing from an early age, and at a certain point got enough confidence that I thought, maybe I can do this. And so when I went to college in those days, there were no courses about comics and certainly no classes teaching comics. So I thought, well, maybe I'll major in art. Well, I found it very quickly. Art professors in those days looked down on comics about as far as you could look down on anything. So I quickly decided, well, I'm going to focus on journalism because half of being a cartoonist is writing, and I'll polish the writing side. And then I co-founded the first humor magazine that the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee ever had, and that helped bolster confidence. So it just gradually evolved into a point when I got out of college, I said, I think I can do this.
And along the way, you were given an assignment as a journalist to cover the underground scene as it was developing in southern Wisconsin.
The Milwaukee Journal was very supportive. That was probably still the biggest paper in the state, but they had a feature editor there who was a part-time professor who taught the history of journalism, and found out quickly he loved comics, and he was friends with some famous cartoonists, notably Walt Kelly.
Wow.
So
Pogo
he actually, yeah. He actually had originals by Kelly and some others, and he was very supportive. In fact, he was probably over-supportive because he kept trying to push me into the syndicated comic strip world. And had I wanted to go that direction, he would have been a very important guy to get a foot in the door for me, but I knew early on I didn't want to do a daily strip. I was so excited about what was going on with the underground comics world, the political scene. I was caught up in it, you know. I didn't want a job. I was a young revolutionary.
Yeah, and in 1970, you took Mom's Homemade Comics to the next step. It morphed into Kitchen Sink Press. And you were actually, at first, a collective of artists in Milwaukee. You had cheap, spacious digs above a laundromat. But a few years later, you moved the operation out to a rural setting. You actually ended up with a number of local creatives who loved coming together and producing this material.
Yeah, I was lucky. And it shows you that any place can have an enclave of cartoonists. You would think, well, in those days, certainly San Francisco was Mecca, without question. And I loved going out there.
Yeah, that was where Robert Crumb and Gilbert Shelton and
yeah,
all
the
those
core
folks
of the group was there, but not everyone. And I mean, even then, it was certainly a more expensive place to live than the Midwest where I was. And I just found there's a lot of talent everywhere. You just have to find it, attract it, coordinate it. I had some early skills, you know, editing, and I had a little business sense, which was more sense than most artists had. And I, by default, became the guy who was taking care of the business side, and that meant I, by default, became a publisher.
Yeah, well, you more than handled the business side. I mean, you became this very successful early underground publisher. You published stories by artists as wide-ranging as Trina Robbins and Robert Crumb.
Yeah, there's oil and water. Yeah, you know, I have to say, there was no business plan. It was moment by moment, week by week. I had certain taste. I certainly was someone who loved to look at a lot of different styles and stories and try to put together anthologies and encourage people. And, you know, sometimes, I'm sure you know this too, there are artists you really like personally, maybe their work doesn't fit, and vice versa. There are some geniuses who are jerks. And you learn to work with all of them and try to work to strengths. And I was lucky enough, because I didn't come in with a real strong, any business background in a formal sense, but I was lucky because at that time there was such a demand for this sort of thing. The hippies were proliferating everywhere, you know. Certainly, again, San Francisco was Mecca, but there were hippies everywhere. And there were head shops everywhere. And the head shops were our bread and butter. We'd get a rack of comics in there, and they were just, you know, spinning it all day. And we didn't have to be geniuses to fill that market, because when demand exceeds supply, you're in a good situation. So we kept feeding it, and for several years, you know, it was a great, prosperous little business, and we felt we were part of something special. It's, you know, hindsight's easy now, but at the time, we just knew we were turning comics on their head. The guys and the women my age who had formed the core of the underground comics had grown up during that period in the 50s when the Comic Code Authority was very oppressive. It had really emasculated the kind of comics I grew up loving, like the horror comics and the crime comics and the ones with lurid covers. Suddenly, you know, in the mid-50s, they became very bland, and a lot of the best ones went out of business, like EC Comics. And so we were so self-confident and full of ourselves then that we said, you know, we're not going to play by the rules. We don't ever want to work for the man. We're going to do our own comics, and nobody's going to tell us what to do. Nobody's going to censor us. We're going to keep our own art. We're going to keep our own copyright, etc. All those things were game changers. And normally it would have been laughable because the big companies were big because they had newsstand distribution. We distributed through a completely unorthodox method, which was primarily the head shops. And they were everywhere, too. And, you know, we also were sold through, you know, some bookstores, used bookstores, some university bookstores, and some mail order. We developed our own mail order division. But really, the core of it was knowing that any self-respecting hippie has to go to a head shop to get his rolling papers and his beads and his Dayglow posters and all those must-have items, and there would be a rack or two of comics. In some cases, it would be a wall of comics. I co-owned a head shop myself in Milwaukee, and we had the Marvel and DC comics of the day, but our underground comics covered an entire wall. So we would bring in comics freaks, and there, you know, in those days, I'm talking the early 70s, wasn't that easy to find a good, reliable source of comics. The drugstores, you know, for them, comics were the least important thing for them. They would get shoved into racks and bent and torn. And if you were a collector, you wanted to go to a place where those comics were mint, at least for most collectors. And so we would cater to that comics audience and, in many cases, convert people from Marvel to Undergrounds, or at least have them reading both. Because these are also people who were probably in a head shop because they're getting stoned, and the Underground comics at least promise some kind of a mind-altering experience to go along with your drug of choice.
And you were also concerned about the art. I mean, so many alternative publications were just going with cheap newsprint, but you were serious about the printing quality.
Well, it's true. It was the aesthetic was important for me. I remember I would pay an extra penny or penny and a half for white paper instead of newsprint because it just looked better to me. But I couldn't raise the retail price, you know, from 50 cents to 52 cents or, you know, 55 cents. So I just ate it. Again, the bottom line was not critical to me. I was not looking to get rich. I just wanted to be able to keep producing this stuff. And it was not a normal business. That said, I couldn't lose money, and I wanted to pay people fairly and all of that, but I wasn't looking at profit as the primary. And that's hard for some people to believe. Now, maybe not in Portland, but I mean, you know, most people just raise your eyebrow when you say you're running a business, you don't care about a profit. My feeling was it would come if we did a good job, you know. And our overhead was relatively low. I wasn't living in a mansion and driving a Cadillac.
Now, and you also were insistent on letting the creators retain editorial and copyright control. So, well, that was one of the reasons why you had great classic comics creators like Basil Wolverton and Harvey Kurtzman coming to you. But that couldn't have been the only reason. You obviously put yourself out there as somebody who could be relied upon.
Well, any publisher has to be. I mean, you know, you can call yourself anything. I mean, I could hand you a card and say I'm a Hollywood producer. It doesn't mean I really can produce a movie. For a publisher to be viable, the most important thing is you pay creators with a check that doesn't bounce and you pay them on time, you give them an honest accounting, and just treat them fairly. And that was not something you could ever take for granted. My first experience was with the print mint in Berkeley after it I had self-published. Remember, I didn't intend to be a publisher. I intended to be a cartoonist. I happened to self-publish my first book because I didn't know how else to get it out there. And it did well enough that I got contacted by the print mint, which was then the Zap publisher. And they said they would reprint my book and publish the second one. And I said, great, that's what I want. I want a publisher. The problem was, after some months, you know, I finally got a check in the mail, just literally a check in an envelope without anything with it. And I just kind of scratched my head and I said, I'm glad I got this money, but it doesn't explain how they got this amount. I just wanted the basics. How many did you print? By the way, what percentage am I getting? And accounting. They could have lied to me, but I just, you know, I just wanted to know how they derived that $407 check they sent me. So I called, and I had never met the owners of the print mint. The fellow I was talking to was a guy named Bob Rita, who I did not know at the time was like a 300-pound Samoan black belt. And I called him, and I started asking these pesky questions. And he said, are you calling me a crook? And when he said that, suddenly I thought, well, you know, I just don't trust it. He wasn't giving me straight answers. Instead of saying, hey, I'm sorry about that, what would you like to know? He was evasive, and it drove me crazy. And that moment, when I hung up that phone, I said, I'm not dealing with those people anymore. I don't trust them. I'm going to go back and do it myself, which is kind of foolish because, again, I'm just one guy working out of Milwaukee. But I'd gotten to know a lot of other artists in the community and in Chicago, particularly Jay Lynch, Skip Williams, and they were doing Bijou Funnies, which was published by Print Mint also. And I was commiserating with them, and Jay said to me, you know, we don't like them either, and we don't trust their accounting either. I said, well, I'm going to just do my own book again. And Jay said, would you do ours too? And talk about stupid, or naive, I guess is a better word. I said, sure, Jay, two's as easy as one, which doesn't even make any sense. But I remember saying that to him very blithely, you know, because it just probably wanted to make him happy, and I just thought I could do it. So what it did, it really put the onus on me to deliver, because it wasn't now just for myself. I had to make my friends in Chicago happy, and I had to show them that what disappointed us with Print Mint would be different. And so I just hustled. I hustled like hell. And I had an energy. I had total focus. At that time, I don't think I had a girlfriend to distract me. I just threw myself into it. And the one advantage I had was I had co-founded the underground paper, the Bugle, which had been part of an exchange program. So there was a thing called the Alternative Press Syndicate. And you would send your papers to every other paper. And so our office got, I don't know, maybe 50 papers a week. And some of the people on the staff would go through and say, you know, hey, what's in the Berkeley Barb this week and whatnot. And they'd get passed around, but then they'd get thrown away. I would collect them all, and I would tear out the ads that would have head shops and odd, weird shops, and that became my mailing list. And so I created a catalog. I sent it to them, and orders poured in. And that's how it worked. It was just common sense hustling that a lot of artists just weren't willing to do. They just wanted to draw.
So Kitchen Sink Press really gained a reputation. And in fact, for 6 months in the mid-1970s, Marvel Comics, one of the big two, DC and Marvel, Marvel Comics experimented with underground publishing. The result was Comics Book, C-O-M-I-X. And that was a project you were asked to direct.
Yeah, that one evolved in a strange way. I had the temerity when I published my first Mom So Made Comics to send a copy to Stan Lee, because I had grown up enjoying the Marvel revival in the early 60s. I truly enjoyed them.
The Silver Age, they call it now.
Yeah, I mean, don't ask me to pick up a Marvel today, but back then I thought they were great, and I just wanted to send Stan something as a fan who, I don't know, just want to kind of say thank you in a way. Here's a little gift, whatever, never expecting a reply. But I knew from his letters columns that he was fan-friendly. And I was pleasantly surprised. He had a nice personal note back encouraging me, saying something funny. And then I answered, not thinking I'd get a reply. And pretty soon we were pen pals, which was a surprise because he's had to be a pretty busy guy. And one of the things that was a trademark for me back then, I used to love creating letterheads and changing them frequently. And he got a big kick out of the letterheads. At one point he called and he said, hey, we got an opening here. You want to come and work for Marvel? And part of me was like, oh my God, that would be so cool. But I said, no, I'm really enjoying what I'm doing. I'm part of something that's my own entity. And, you know, thanks, but no thanks. And he was a little stunned because I don't think he'd ever offered a fanboy a job who turned him down. And that almost made him hungrier. So every few months we would talk and he would say, you know, so Mr. Big Shot in Milwaukee doesn't want to come to New York and work for Stan the Man. And I'd go, yeah. Now, again, thanks, Stan. I appreciate it. I'm flattered, but no. And then something finally developed, which was out of my control, which we called the Crash of 73. What happened was there was a Supreme Court decision. I think it was it Miller versus California? I forget offhand. Basically, the Supreme Court threw the definition of obscenity back to localities, which was kind of crazy because their reasoning was, well, you know, what's obscene in Podunk, Kansas might be different than what's obscene in New York or Los Angeles, whatever. But it just threw a lot of confusion. And what it really did was it put a real scare into places like head shops. Because here they are, already vulnerable, they're selling drug paraphernalia, they're probably not very welcome in most communities, and they've got a rack of things which arguably contain obscenity, depending on the eye of the beholder, right? So if you're a muckety-muck, you know, cop or prosecutor, you want to walk into a head shop and pull up a few things and say, this is obscene, you're under arrest. In essence, it caused a good number of shops to just stop carrying comics. And at the same time, there was kind of a glut because one of the things that distinguished us was we sold on a non-returnable basis. We gave a deeper discount, but we didn't want comics back. And a lot of them wouldn't order necessarily in a wise way. You know, Let's just say you said everything in the list, give me a dozen of each. Well, the dozen Freak Brothers would sell right away, but, you know, somebody else's might only sell a handful. So we were in a situation where our sales were really diminishing in a way that made us afraid we'd survive. And my partner at the time and I were wondering, you know, it's been a nice ride, but maybe it's over. And then Stan called, expecting the usual conversation, and he said, so I don't suppose you're interested in working for Marvel still? And I said, well, you know what? Let's talk. Maybe. So he flew me out to New York, and the result was the magazine you mentioned, which was basically, keep in mind, at the same time, Stan's about probably 50 years old, and he's doing the college tour. He's popular because Marvel's a phenomenon. But he sees the underground comics happening. I'm sure a lot of students at the campuses are asking him about underground comics, and he wants to be part of it in some way. He wants to be seen as hip and with it because, you know, he's a middle-aged guy. And so he gave me the authority to put together this magazine with a significant budget, and I talked him out of moving to New York. So I was able to take a New York salary, stay in Milwaukee, and do this magazine.
Well, there were some pretty impressive names of artists who contributed to Comics Book. Harvey Pekar, Kim Deitch, Basil Wolverton, Howard Cruz. And it actually contained the first three-page version of Art Spiegelman's Mouse.
Yeah, it gave it its first exposure, really. So yeah, it was fun. I mean, Trina told me later that she bought her house in San Francisco based on the money she made from Comics Book. And, you know, that house now in San Francisco is probably worth $1 million. So it affected people's lives deeply. It also, for the first time, introduced underground cartoonists to a whole new audience that wasn't going into head shops, because this was sold on newsstands. You could find it in a drugstore or a place where magazines were sold. And I've been told many times over the years that's what turned on some young readers to this whole new breed of cartoonists and non-superhero stuff. So I don't regret it. It wouldn't have come about had we not had an economic crisis in the business. But also, I have to say, you know, Stan Lee had his detractors, but to me, he was a man who kept his word, and he was a gentleman, and he gave me an opportunity. Now, that said, he pulled the plug on it pretty quick, because in order to get me and the contributors to work for him, he had to make concessions, including, you know, we got to keep our artwork. And I argued that we had to have our copyrights. We kind of compromised initially, but eventually got them all. We were not allowed to do anything we want, but he allowed a limited amount of nudity and swear words. And you can imagine we negotiated for a long time over where to draw that line, and it was never drawn sharply. But it was unlike any other Marvel comic. And as a result, imagine if you were one of the guys working for Marvel, cranking out one of their superheroes, and you heard that these hippies were getting these special concessions. They gave them hell, I think. And indirectly, I would hear about it. So basically, he had opened Pandora's box, couldn't quite put it back except for killing the magazine, and then telling these guys, well, that was just a fling. I'm still happily married to you. And they went back to their old rules. But even then, Pandora's box was never quite shut. And they, before long, they had to start returning art and had to start paying some royalties and residuals. It put a dent in the old system, which I think was a good thing, too. So everyone benefited.
Well, a lot of people had really complicated relationships with Stan Lee. I mean, he considered himself the impresario of the comics world of Marvel, and he loved control. And, well, there's one team-up you talk about where Harvey Kurtzman, who was a giant of the comics industry, a co-founder of Mad Magazine, you ended up publishing many of Harvey's later works, including Goodman Beaver. Harvey had a relationship with Stan Lee that was that was pretty infuriating from the sound of things.
Well, yes and no. understand that at the beginning of both of their careers, you're talking two very young people here, Stan,
back in the 30s, 40s?
Back in, well, I would say early 40s, from memory. Martin Goodman owned the publishing company that included the Timely Comics line that later came to be known as Marvel. And Martin Goodman was mostly putting out a lot of schlock, you know, so-called men's magazines and crossword puzzle magazines and whatnot. And his comics line, you got to remember, comics in those days, they were aimed at kids. They were 10 cents. They were the lowest of the low. And he was a frugal guy. And his wife had an, I think it was the nephew of his wife, was Stanley Lieber. And he said, you know, we can get that kid cheap. He's a teenager. He can run a comic book company. Who can't crank out comics, right? So at the same time, there's another young guy named Harvey Kurtzman who's out of the Army and freelancing. And he came up with this Hey Look series, which was basically a filler. And for listeners who don't know what that means, it's like any magazine trying to sell advertising, of course, and you don't know right up until you go to press if you've sold quite enough advertising for what you save space for. And so if suddenly there's a blank page, you put in what's called a filler. Hey Look was a filler. It ran when it had a blank page. So while I just told you comic books were the lowest of the low, fillers were the lowest of the comic books, okay? But it was the way Harvey made a living. So Stan was his employer, technically. And the real story here, I mean, if you don't mind my digressing, is at a certain point in the early 1940s, Stan put an ad in the paper for what they used to call a right-hand girl, who was secretary, gopher, all-purpose assistant. And a young woman named Adele Hassan, right out of college, basically interviewed, got the job. And one of her many tasks at one point was when Stan decided to run an ad in all of their comics asking kids to tell them, what's your favorite feature? We'll give a crisp $1 bill to the person we pull out of a hat, right? Now, granted, a dollar bill back then was maybe 20 now, but it was a marketing thing, a reader survey. And he said,
kind of like a Facebook test nowadays.
Yeah, the equivalent. So Adele's task, among many others, was when those things come in, throw them in a box, and then at some point count them and give me the tally, right? So she loved Hey Look. She thought Harvey was cute. She thought his stuff was hilarious. And she was very dismayed as she's looking at these ballots that are coming back, and he's getting virtually no attention from the readers. And she's angry about that. So she does something that I think changes the course of comics history. She stuffs the ballot box, gives the tally sheet to Stan Lee. Stan looks at it, and he goes, wow, we got to give that kid Harvey some more work. So Harvey starts coming in more often, flirtation gets a little heavier, and the next thing you know, they eventually married. You know, you can argue, had she not done that, there may not have been those EC War comics, there may not have been Mad, go on and on. Who knows? We'll never know, but to me, that was a very significant moment in comics history. Did I digress?
You digressed beautifully, actually. I think that's the kind of story I don't know if I've seen it written anywhere else.
It's in The Art of Harvey Kurtzman,
okay.
If you get into the weeds.
Oh, okay, if you get into the weeds, right.
Yeah.
I may be going out on a limb here myself, but I would say that your collaboration with Stan Lee, comics book, might have had an outsized influence on Marvel Comics. When I was a kid in the late 70s, suddenly there were all these amazing psychedelic stories coming out of Marvel Comics. There was Doctor Strange, Howard the Duck, Swamp Thing. I mean, these things were all over the place. They had amazing colors and images and surrealistic storylines. I can't help but think that the underground publishers rubbed off a little bit on the Marvel Comics bullpen.
Well, yeah, again, who can ever say? I'd like to think so, but you know, I don't know that Stan Lee was, you know, I should actually say Steve Ditko was, you know, dropping acid and drawing Doctor Strange. They were trippy, there's no question. And I remember we used to kind of speculate if, you know, those guys were really on anything. But later on, as I found out more about, like, Steve Ditko, he was, I think, about as straight as they come and politically about as right as you can come. And it's hard for me to believe in retrospect that these were guys affected by psychedelics anyway.
Well, I think he, as Salvador Dali once said of himself, and Salvador Dali was fairly right-wing, he said, "I don't do drugs, I am drugs."
Yeah,
and I think
that's
that,
true.
That would apply to Steve Ditko as well.
Yeah, I never met him. I understand he was a strange guy, so I love his work, but I don't have any insight into that particular influence. I just think, man, part of this is generational. Just because, let's say, I chose to be an underground cartoonist and make less money because I wanted the control, I didn't begrudge a guy my age who went to work for Marvel. It'd be an inker, penciler, writer. But he was the same generation. He was probably, you know, imbibing in the same things and watching the same movies and reading the same science fiction and so on. So that, I saw it as in parallel. It just, there were different business models, and I much preferred our business model. But the guy's going to make a living. If he's going to do it penciling Spider-Man, that's his choice. But I think you got to look at it from a generational perspective.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm S.W. Conser, and my guest today is author, archivist, biographer, publisher, and underground cartoonist Dennis Kitchen. Dennis was a longtime friend and collaborator of the legendary comics artist and writer Will Eisner, and has published dozens of Eisner's works. Yeah, let's talk about Will Eisner. He was one of the most prolific comics artists in history, and he started out creating stories as a teenager in the 1930s.
Yeah, literally as a teenager, when the comics business was just beginning. He was amazingly prolific, and he also was unusual in that he had, you know, both the right brain, left brain thing going. He was an astute businessman, just instinctively. Again, this is a guy who never had an education beyond high school. In fact, technically, he didn't graduate from high school because he didn't pass geometry, I think it was.
Well, that's interesting, since, I mean, he was the king of geometry in the comics.
Yeah, it is ironic, isn't it? But again, it just, it shows you, you know, what innate talent can overcome. Also, again, the opportunity, kind of like I was able to be at the ground floor of something because of circumstances and timing, so was he in a different era. In my case, I got to at least see the work of the generation that came before me. In his case, he was building the building blocks. There were no comic books. There had been newspaper strips, of course, since the 1890s, and they were hugely popular. But comic books were really the invention of a printer who just saw an opportunity to take popular newspaper comics and fold them to a smaller size and sell them on newsstands. And that proved to be a successful venture. And so they began doing more of those. And at a certain point, they were running out of newspaper strips. And so a guy named Major Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson started Detective Comics. And shortly after that, you know, that's when Superman hit the newsstands and changed a lot of things. So Will was in an industry that suddenly needed a lot of original material. So he, with a partner named Jerry Iger, created a packaging shop. And they originally, it was basically just Will under many pseudonyms. But then they hired a steadily a growing staff of people that included Jack Kirby and Bob Kane and Bob Powell and Mort Meskin, and just go down the list.
It's a rogues gallery right
there. Yeah, Joe Kubert, all these young kids, mostly Jewish kids in New York. It was at that point an almost entirely Jewish industry at every level. from the artists, editors, publishers, printers.
And they became just incredible big shots. Joe Kubert founded an art school for comics artists.
Yeah, and two of his sons are current stars. I mean, it's a family tradition.
Well, Will Eisner, I mean, he's best known for The Spirit, which is the long-form newspaper comic that just bent all the rules of the art form. But, you know, himself, just Eisner was so far ahead of his time. The Spirit was really a hybrid of the newspaper comic and the comic book.
It was. It was a one-of-a-kind. Hybrid is the right word. If your local newspaper carried it, you'd open your Sunday paper and it would fall on your lap. It's kind of a free comic book.
It was also a hybrid of the detective novel and the superhero comic.
Yeah, the Syndicate wanted some kind of a superhero. Will didn't want to do superhero. He gave the character a mask and on kind of a flimsy premise. You know, he never liked it. For him, it was all about telling stories. And in a lot of the stories, the Spirit is rather incidental. He's on the sidelines, or it's really stories about other characters. Because that's what he saw his role, his entire career, being a storyteller. And I think for him, moving from comic books that were 10 cents and sold at the time what he called 14-year-old cretins from Kansas was his favorite way of summing it up. Whereas in newspapers, at least he thought he was reaching adult readers and people who were more literate, and reached a lot more people. The circulation cumulatively of those newspapers was far more than physical comic books that would have been sold.
You dug up a newspaper article from October of 1941 that just shows how far ahead of his time Will Eisner was. And this is an interview in the Philadelphia Record. I'll quote the article. "The comic strip," he explains, this is talking about Will Eisner, "is no longer a comic strip, but in reality an illustrated novel. It is new and raw in form just now, but material for limitless intelligent development. And eventually and inevitably, it will be a legitimate medium for the best of writers and artists. It is already the embryo," Eisner apologizes a little for the trite phrase, "of a new art form. And he believes in it and will stay with it proudly and without apologies." This is almost 80 years ago.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I never cease to be amazed by that quote, because it just shows what a true visionary he was. Because it took a long time for the world to catch up to him. He was an old man when he saw really his vision come true, but at least he saw it. But he spent his entire career working toward that goal, when virtually none of his contemporaries thought like he did. He told me when he joined the National Cartoonist Society early on, he was the token comic book guy, because these were the newspaper strip artists. But because,
and editorial cartoonists as well.
Yeah, but comic book guys weren't welcome, but because his comic book was inserted in a newspaper, he kind of got in on a technicality. And so he got to know people like Al Capp and Milton Caniff and, Rube Goldberg, all the giants of the day. And he told me when he would be, this basically was a social club. They'd have their club meetings at a bar in New York and shoot the bull. And whenever he would try to get serious and talk about the potential of comics, he said they would just look at him askance and they would just really furrow their eyebrows. And he said Rube Goldberg told him one time, "Young man, we're just here to sell newspapers. Don't get so uppity," or something to that effect. They saw themselves as entertainers. And Will saw it as more than that. And that's why by the time I finally met him in 1971, he had heard about underground comics, hadn't seen them, but he had heard the business model was very different and was very open, and There were really no guidelines. They were distributed different. Artists were paid different, all these things. And so he was intensely curious, and he sought me out at a time when I was a virtual nobody, and he was a legend already.
Yeah, you were very early in the publishing field, but you were a huge fan. And as you said, you were part of a very different comics scene from the one he recognized.
Absolutely. But what I found, I mean, I was thrilled that I got to meet him and talk to him. And I saw right away what later I came to realize was just a part of Will's natural curiosity. But he wanted to know exactly what we were doing, how we were doing it, who the audience was, the whole economics of it. And I remember vividly that at the time I thought, this is the only time I'll ever see Will Eisner in person, and I want to ask him questions. And so whenever there is a little opportunity, I'd say, so, Will, I want to hear what it was like in the old days. And he'd say, no, let's talk about what you're doing. He had no interest in revisiting the past, at least in that first meeting. And what it was for him was he saw the big picture, which is he saw that the model he had to work under in the 1930s and 40s was a very oppressive, onerous system where the publisher really had everything. You did it work for hire, you know, they kept the artwork, they told you what to do, you couldn't deviate from really any of the rules, maybe creatively to some extent, but even if you did something wonderful, they owned it anyway, so why would you bother? Suddenly he saw where a young artist could create something, they could control it, and they could own it, both the physical art and the copyright and the trademark and the whatever ancillary might come out of that. And it intrigued him to the extent that we agreed to stay in touch, and soon after that, I persuaded him that I could reprint some of the old spirits, which he was skeptical about. He said, why would your audience, which looks like you, you know, long hair and bell bottoms and smoking stuff I don't smoke, why would they be interested in this old crap, you know? And I said, well, just trust me. I said, there's a lot of fans who are curious about what came before. I'm one of them. My gut instinct tells me there's more. I'm willing to take that chance. And he said, okay. And I proved to him. I was able to sell at that time about 20,000 copies of something that he thought was way too obscure to sell. And so that just began a long journey that initially was about the spirit, but ultimately was the next big stage of both his career and the trajectory of the comics business, which is graphic novels, when he changed everything again.
It sounds as if Will Eisner was always open to new experiences, even into his 70s and 80s.
Absolutely. He loved meeting artists, especially young artists. He loved comparing notes, even techniques. When the digital age began to come into being, he was curious about using it for research and was intrigued by the idea of e-books. All these things, when they were just beginning to be talked about, he wasn't fearful of them. He looked at it as opportunity. When Scott McCloud wrote Understanding Comics, he and Will used to enjoy debating each other because they didn't always agree, but they loved debating because it was about ideas and it was about the medium they both loved. And it's exciting to meet someone who's older, but they're still young in terms of their thinking. They're not stultified, you know, they're not ossified. They're just fresh thinkers. Occasionally, you know, I meet them in different fields, but Will, to me, was the exemplar of that, and I never cease to be impressed by it. And he would pick my brain, too, when mostly we talked on the phone because I lived for the most part in the Midwest when he was in New York. And then when I went to Massachusetts, he was in Florida. We'd see each other a few times a year, but mostly it was on the phone and writing letters. And I always had to be prepared because when he would call me, he would ask questions that would test my, you know, knowledge of the market at that moment in time, because he would hear something like, such and such a distributor was slow paying their bills. Were they going out of business? How would that affect us? And I had to be able to say, no, that's a false rumor, or yes, they are. I'm worried too. And he was monitoring things in a way that you could never assume he was, you know, just at the drawing board and focused on his own work. And he also proved to be a great mentor because he had such a history and such a business mind that when I was worried about something or not sure if I should, you know, maybe borrow money and expand or do this or that, I would just call and pick his brain. And there were times when, just like that crash of 73, I would say, well, I'm worried. It looks like things are going south fast. And he said to me one time, don't worry, Dennis. I've seen this industry die 4 times. And it was both funny and depressing and reassuring all at the same time. Because he had been there. And he just saw this was an industry that was changing. And change is always scary. It shakes things up. But comics will continue.
Now, as amazing a relationship as you had with Will Eisner. His first introduction to underground comics was not auspicious. And this was back in the early 70s where you first met at, was it the Chicago Comic Convention?
No, this was the Commodore Hotel in New York City. It was a Phil Suing convention. First one I had ever been at. And we were both kind of new to the idea of fans descending in a hotel and tables full of back issues and just stuff that, you know, was an exciting new invention in itself. So, yeah, he, through an intermediary, he sought me out on the floor, and I was even skeptical. A Frenchman named Maurice Horn, who was a comics historian, who had actually put together the first comics exhibit at the Louvre, of all places, he saw me. I must have a badge with my name or something. And he said, in his French accent, Mr. Will Eisner, he wants to meet you. And I was sure that there was a language problem or some misunderstanding. And I said, I don't know Mr. Eisner. I don't think he's looking for me. And he said, no. He insisted I come with him. And sure enough, what had happened was Will knew about undergrounds, and Phil Suling, the impresario, had told him enough that made him curious. But after he peppered my brain with all these questions, he admitted he hadn't actually seen any, and he said he'd like to. And so we went down to the floor and went to a section where there were 2 or 3 tables full, all face up. And I was going to select 1 or 2 to show him, but he just impulsively grabbed one, and it was, I think, Zap number 2. But I know the page. It was Captain Piscums by S. Clay Wilson. And it wasn't just, you know, I mean, Wilson is dangerous anyway, but this was one where
he was the creator of the Checkered Demon, which was notorious.
Yeah, Wilson's the one who taught Crumb how to draw dirty. So he was the epitome of the outrageous outskirts of what underground comics were doing. So, yeah, I don't even know if, you know, you want your radio audience to even know what it was Will saw, but it shocked him. And after a short conversation, I think he showed his generational shock. Basically said to me, I had no idea they were this graphic. And I tried to explain that this was a bit of an extreme, that there were all kinds of underground comics. Just because they were uncensored didn't mean everyone went to the extremes. But
then you were interrupted by a very young Art Spiegelman.
Yeah, he happened to be there when he was basically a nobody, and he just happened to pick up on the conversation and argue in defense of S. Clay Wilson, which didn't help matters. And so after the three of us had this short and vigorous discussion, Will excused himself, and I was confident I would never see him again. And I was kind of annoyed that Art had, you know, made it worse. But the good news is I had kept Will's business card. And in those pre-digital days, I wrote him a letter and said how happy I was to meet him, and I enjoyed our conversation. I said, I'm sorry you picked up a comic you found offensive. So I said, I'm enclosing half a dozen or so that I think show a broader array of what's out there, and maybe you'll find them worthwhile. And a bit later, I got a letter back, and he thanked me very much, and he said, yes, he had enjoyed those, and he'd like to talk further. So that was the kind of interesting beginning. Could have gone real bad. If he had walked away without my having his business card, I don't know that I would have, you know, really followed up. And, you know, I couldn't have been sure that even the non-S. Clay Wilson comics would have appealed to him. But it was one of the other things I found about Will was he was open to what a younger generation was doing in a way that I found very, very few of his contemporaries were interested. The other old-timers, they were interested in other old-timers. You know, they were interested in the stuff they had done their whole career. They weren't interested in what these long-haired kids were doing. Why would they? But Will did. Harvey Kurtzman was the other one who was very open and receptive, and I guess not coincidentally, those are two of the leading geniuses of their generation. I think that was part of their genius, not being closed.
Well, it's a welcome development all around that you and Will Eisner developed a friendship, because it was working with you that he developed really the long-form comic story, and he was the first artist to call his work a graphic novel.
Right. I always put an asterisk on it because there was a fanzine that used that term, and historians will always point to that. But
well, ironically, he preferred the term sequential art when talking about comics.
But Contract with God did on the cover say graphic novel, and it was the first one to declare itself that, and that's the name that caught on. And to me, he's the guy who started the whole revolution. And there had been some forerunners. I always like to point out Harvey Kurtzman's Jungle Book, because that was a big, big influence on me and a lot of the other undergrounders. That came out in 1959, and it was wonderful. But it flopped, totally flopped. And another 10 years earlier, there was a thing called It Rhymes with Lust that was put out by St. John Publishing. It was even a bigger flop, such a big flop that I think one of the fanzines that monitor these things, they said there are only 7 known copies that, you know, collectors have, I don't know, slabbed or however they count these things. And so when Contract with God came along, it benefited from the fact that by 1978 we had comic shops, we had organized fandom. The fact that fans were talking to each other, reviewing things, criticizing things, there was a chance, you know, on a small scale, what today you'd say going viral. Before that, when Harvey did Jungle Book, you didn't know the fan that might have been on the other side of town. How would you ever find out? There was no comic shop to meet him at. There was no fanzine. There was no internet. There were just little isolated pockets of fandom. So Will benefited from that, but still, inherently, it was just something very special. And you had a guy who was already a master of comic art suddenly doing this semi-autobiographic work about people that seemed very real. And they didn't wear capes, and they didn't have superpowers. It was just gritty stories about New York and the Depression. And it wasn't in color, and it wasn't even in black and white. He wanted it in sepia. It was just totally different, and it had a square binding. I remember just holding it the first time and looking and going, wow, I can put that on my shelf, and I can find it. It's not a stapled pamphlet like we thought comic books had to be. And as obvious it seems now, it seems so obvious, why can't comics be fatter? Why can't they have a spine? Why can't they be like real books? But it took someone like Will Eisner to make it happen then. I think inevitably it would have happened, but he was there first.
I think one of the things that may have made A Contract with God, which was Will Eisner's breakout graphic novel, what might have made it so popular is that it was so personal. And I think a lot of readers don't realize just how personal that book was.
Right. It looked fictional, but elements of it were quite autobiographical. The most touching was the lead story where the rabbi, Frimmy Hirsch, adopts a baby, raises the young girl, and when it's a young girl, it suddenly dies, and it's extremely angry because he thinks he has a contract with God, and that little girl's death turned out to be autobiographical, and no one at the time knew outside of his family. I knew Will for several years before I finally found out that he had his only daughter contract leukemia at the age of 15, and I think she died at 16. And their only other child, their son, who was slightly older, became schizophrenic at that time and became estranged. And so within a short period of time, Will and his wife Anne lost both of their children, which is an unimaginable thing to anyone who's a parent. And yet he chose not to deal with it overtly. He put it in this ostensibly fictional piece of work in a very dramatic way. And when I read it again, every time I reread it, and I see the downpour on this character because he's buried his daughter in the midst of this gush of water pouring down, and I realize those are his tears. That's the way he dealt with it. It's a very emotional. And there are other aspects in the book, too, that are him. And there's even one story where the character is called Willie, and you know it's him. But it's in many cases, he disguised it. I recently, 2 years ago, my partner John Lind and I put together a deluxe version of Contract with God for Dark Horse. I don't know if you've seen it yet, but it's two volumes. One is all of the pencils that survived and all of the inked version, because Will inked it on vellum, which preserved the pencil. So it's a unique way to see the before and after. And for me, it was like comics archaeology, because some of his artwork had paste overs that were done with rubber cement. And you may know rubber cement, after a few years, it dries. And when I picked up the page where the young Frimmy Hirsch is sitting in the Siberian wilderness writing this contract with God as a boy, that paper fell off, and underneath it was the actual contract, the legal language, which initially my action was, this is hilarious, because Will was such a businessman. His first instinct was to actually write the contract with God. Now, he thought better of it, for a lot of reasons, and I can only speculate, because when Will was with us, I didn't know there was art hidden under the art. But I know what he was thinking, and I also think that the editor in him realized that having the actual contract in the book would be a bit of a distraction, and the kid was only, I think, 12 years old or so anyway, and how could he have written language that Will Eisner wrote? So anyway, there are a number of things like that. The story about the Super 2, there's some interesting material that he penciled but never inked. And it gives you greater depth into the making of this work, and you can speculate whether, you know, it was wise to have excluded it or should he have included it. A lot of the balloons, too, he changed the language when he finally inked it. So it's an unusual opportunity to see a master comic artist's thought process. That's what I love about it.
Well, he was a world creator.
Yeah, yeah.
And you published a tribute to Will Eisner on what would have been his 100th birthday, a centennial tribute back in 2017.
Yeah, I arranged to curate two simultaneous art exhibits. We had enough art that we had one in France at the what's effectively the National Museum of Comic Art in Angoulême, where they have the big festival every year. And then at the same time, we had a show at the Society of Illustrators in New York. So the book is basically a compilation of the best from both shows, shot from the original art at the highest resolution. So if you never had a chance to look at any original Eisner art firsthand or hold it in your hand, this book is the closest thing to it. And, you know, this art now is getting to be quite valuable if you follow, like, heritage auctions and things like that. But the point of art books like that is to just share the original creation as much as possible, because the reproductions often lose a lot, not just reduced, but the line quality is often diminished, the whiteouts, subtle shading, the spilled coffee, all that stuff. I like to see it. Notations on the side, the erasures. So I think we're seeing more and more of those. IDW, Dark Horse, other publishers have been putting out these wonderful artist edition type things. And so this was our version for that book that we think is so important.
And the Eisner Awards are considered the Oscars of the comics industry. They've been given out at the San Diego Comic-Con since 1988, when Will was still with us.
Yeah, it was cool because he would be on stage. So if you got to walk up on stage and get it, he would hand it to you. So yeah, it was a good experience. To me, it was the culmination for Will of seeing from that young man who was about 23 years old to have him in his 70s and his 80s see an award named after him, to see all these amazing new works come out that he could bestow this award on personally. It just brought it all full circle. I just thought it was a wonderful thing that he lived long enough to see that and to be the Oscar and to get some adulation while he could still appreciate it. Because for many years he worked in virtual anonymity, you know. Might have had fans, but in those days you didn't see your fans. It's not like you're a musician and you hear the applause. If you're a cartoonist, you don't hear the applause.
I know you have a busy schedule, but before you go, I wanted to ask you about the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. The current head of the CBLDF is Charles Brownstein, who's a friend of yours and a friend of the show, but you were really the founder.
Yeah, I mean, again, I never realized at the time that it would turn into this venerable organization. At the time, what happened was I was a publisher still in Wisconsin, and I got a call from a retailer in suburban Chicago who said the cops had come in and busted one of his shops and arrested the manager, confiscated a dozen or so titles, and one of them was one that I published called Omaha the Cat Dancer, which was an anthropomorphic kind of a soap opera, but it had erotic elements, and I certainly didn't think it was pornographic by any means. It was erotic, but it was literate, and I was indignant, and I said, well, what's going to happen? And he said, well, yeah, I just wanted to let you know. He said, I hired an attorney, and hopefully it'll go away. What happened was he hired an attorney who really was just a general lawyer, didn't have any special skills with First Amendment issues. They had an expert witness who botched things. Everything went wrong, and the manager was convicted and was facing some months in jail and a big fine. And at that moment, I got really angry that this could happen, that this kind of a basic violation of the First Amendment in the medium I loved. And so I told him, I said, I'm going to raise some money. We got to get a top-rate attorney to overturn this. And so the first thing I did was approach a lot of the artists I knew who had big followings, starting with like Sergio Aragonés and Robert Crumb and Will Eisner. And I think I got a dozen different artists, and I got my printer to print it at cost. I got distributors at the time to agree to not pass along their profit, basically to get as much money as possible from this, and fans were very supportive. So with the money from that, I found an attorney, Bert Joseph, in Chicago, who had been basically Hugh Hefner's attorney, and I said, we need to overturn this case. And so he was able, on a technicality, to overturn it, because you know, it's hard. You have to find some flaw in the original one. So once he overturned it and the manager was off the hook and we felt vindicated, I still had at that point, I think, somewhere in between $10,000 and $20,000 in the bank. And it wasn't my money. I'd raised it for this cause. So at that point, I decided, well, I either have to give it to another charity, or maybe there'll be another case or two like this, and we should just, have a permanent organization. So I gave it its name, and I recruited some people on the board. And once we really were publicized, we found out what I guess I feared was happening but wished wasn't, which was that we're busts all over the country now and then that we never heard about because they were localized. Retailers were intimidated, and they just gave up. They would say, okay, I won't sell those anymore. Or in one case, the shop went out of business because the headline implied they were pornographers. And so there were these horrible situations that suddenly there was an umbrella organization that you as a retailer could call this 800 number, and the money we were raising would be used to pay a first-rate attorney to try to save you, assuming you didn't do something stupid like sell S. Clay Wilson to a 10-year-old, we would defend you. And that's how it started in 1988, I think. And it keeps growing and evolving. And now a good part of that work is educational. Again, it's headquartered in Portland, so Portland can be proud. It's got another great nonprofit. Charles travels all over the country speaking about it, and the good work continues. After 18 years, I resigned. I just felt fresh blood was needed, but it's still my favorite organization, my favorite charity. And any of your listeners who are sympathetic and don't know about it, you go online, find out about it.
Yeah, how could people support the comic book?
Can support it literally with donations, but also at conventions. It usually has a booth, and they sell books that are donated by artists that are often autographed, and you can buy that book and enjoy the book, but know that the money is going to the fund. You can become a member. I would just say go online.
Yeah, what's the website for the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund?
CBLDF.com.
All right. And if listeners want to find out more about your work, well, Kitchen Sink Press is no longer with us, but more recently you've been collaborating with designer John Lind and Dark Horse founder Mike Richardson. You launched a new imprint called Kitchen Sink Books.
Yes, we do a couple of books a year on subjects that are near and dear to our heart. The one I mentioned about Contract with God, the deluxe, we call it the Curator Collection. We talked about the Marvel Experiment Comics book earlier. We did a collection of that. We did Harvey Kurtzman's Jungle Book in a deluxe edition. So it's work, I would say, by acknowledged masters or just things we feel excited to do. We did a big giant version of Frank Miller's first Sin City book from the original art, that sort of thing.
Wow. So You're still
keeping
very
busy.
Serious about
keeping busy.
Well,
absolutely.
You're still very serious about making stuff look good.
Well, thanks, Conch. Appreciate that.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And my guest today has been author, artist, comics publisher, and historian, Dennis Kitchen. Dennis, thanks so much for joining us in the studio today.
No problem. My pleasure. Carry on.
And many thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at kboo.fm. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @wordsandpicture.